Hi there, thanks for joining me today. I'm Athena, the author of Pollinators.info, and you're listening to podcast episode 3. This is an interview with Dr. Nathan Muchala, who studies pollinating bats in the neotropics, and he's going to be telling us about the tube-lipped nectar bat and the coevolution with the plants that it pollinates. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
How would you describe your job or your position? How would you briefly describe your current research on tube-lipped nectar bat?
I'm looking at coevolution between it and the flowers it visits. So I looked at different habitats throughout its range and looked at what flowers it was visiting and then did some experiments as to how or why the flower and the bat might be coevolving together.
And could you explain coevolution really quick for people that might not be familiar with that term? And so how long are the flowers on the bat's tongue?
The bat's tongue, I measured on average, is 8.5 centimeters. The flowers are pretty similar, about up to like 9 centimeters deep.
So what are the flowers that the bat's pollinating?
This particular one, it doesn't have a common name. It's called Centropoga nigricans. There's one species that I've worked a lot with that has really long flowers. And they're different. They're not your typical flowers. They basically look like a long green tube. They produce a really strong odor to attract the bats, and they make a lot of nectar, which is what the bats are interested in.
Right. So what kind of plant is this? Is it like an orchid or a bromeliad?
It's a bellflower. The family is Campanulaceae.
Okay. And so where does your research take place?
In Ecuador. That's where I most have worked. Ecuador, South America. And the bat, we discovered it in 2005 and described it as a new species. And since then, they've been finding it in other countries. They've actually just found it all the way south in Bolivia, which is pretty far away.
Okay.
And in Colombia, so it has a fairly wide range.
So can you describe the bat a little bit for people? Like, how big is it and what color it is?
Sure. Nectar bats tend to be very small. They're about the size of your fist. The body length is about 6 centimeters. And let's see, they only occur in the southwest of the United States, but they're most common in tropical habitats. And they're basically mammal versions of hummingbirds, furry versions of hummingbirds. They can hover in place, and they have elongated snouts, longer than normal bats, and they can extend their tongues pretty far outside of their mouth.
What color are they? What would they look like to someone who saw one for the first time? Little brown bat?
Yep, brown and furry.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the bat's life history? Like, how long does it live?
Sure. Bats in general tend to live longer than you would expect for something that's that small. Mice, for example, just live a few years. Bats tend to live about 15 or 20 years.
Oh, that is longer than I would have thought.
Yeah.
So the nectar bats are obviously getting carbohydrates from the nectar. Do they ever eat insects for protein? Or where do they get protein? Do they eat some of the pollen?
They eat pollen. That's a pretty important source.
Okay.
I don't think that they actually go to flowers and eat anthers directly, like, to try and get pollen directly, but they grow their fur.
Oh, okay.
They get a lot of proteins from pollen. And some of them eat insects, too. I've been working for a while with trying to figure out what they're eating based on the feces of bats.
Mm.
Always find insect parts. It's not that clear whether they're actively hunting the insects or just kind of accidentally eating them when they visit flowers.
So how long have people in general been studying nectar bats?
It's fairly new. So the taxonomy behind nectar bats would be they started that maybe in the mid-1800s. In other words, just taking specimens to museums, describing the different types of species of nectar bats. But you couldn't really study nectar bats bats, or bats in general, in much detail. Probably scientists started using fish nets.
Mm-hmm.
And these are really fine nets, basically like fishing nets, that you set out at night and catch the bats in. So before they could do that, it was a lot more difficult to study them.
So do you use a mist net with your research? What would be involved in a typical night of you collecting data?
A typical night would be I would set up the nets first when it's still light outside, and then you open them. Maybe you choose places in the forest, like maybe crossing paths, places where you expect that they'll be flying around, mm-hmm. or in front of flowers, of course, if you think that they visit certain flowers. So I would set up the nets, and then the rest of the night I would wait somewhere nearby the nets and check them every half an hour and remove any bats that are captured. And for nectar bats, I would take the pollen off of their fur. So any pollen that's on their fur, that's a record of what they've been visiting recently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the main data that I collect. But then I also do experiments with them where I'll hold them for a few days before releasing them. I'll hold them in a screen tent and try different experiments as far as which flowers they prefer, how the length of the flowers affects how well they pollinate, things like that.
So when this particular bat is visiting this flower that you were talking about, where does it collect the pollen on its body?
On the top of the head. So this is one way that plants share bats as pollinators. Bats basically want to visit anything in a forest. So plants often have the problem of how do they guarantee that they're getting pollen from the same species?
Mm-hmm.
How do they avoid having their pollen mixed up with all the other plants in the forest? So one thing that they can do is they can put the pollen on really precise regions of the bodies of bats. And this particular plant, Centrobolna nigricans, uses the top of bat's forehead.
Where does the pollen end up, or other flowers?
There's different species use just about every part of bats. There's some that put them under bat's wings. There's some that just use bat's belly. There's a species of bromelia that uses pretty far down the back of the bat.
Okay. I didn't realize there was so much diversity in where it would go. I was just thinking they stick their face in and that's where they get it.
There's flowers that'll have the cup that they put their head in is pretty small, but it'll have like long anthers that go all the way back to the back of the bat or under the bat. And there's actually, it turns out that the position of where they're putting their pollen on the bat's body is really important to whether they co-evolve with the bat or not.
Right. What do you think are some interesting results of your recent research?
Well, so one thing I was trying to figure out now is why this bat would evolve such a long time. So this new species of bat is pretty remarkable in that its tongue reaches so long and it stores it in the rib cage when it's not extending it. So that's not atypical for many other mammals. Anteaters actually do that, but no other bats do that. So why would it have evolved such a long tongue? And I did some experiments where I found that longer flowers are pollinated better by the bat, but I couldn't quite figure out why that is. What's the benefit of having a longer flower? A good start is that the flower can specialize on just one of the bats in the forest, so it's going to avoid maybe the other bats in the forest don't do it as good of a job at pollinating it. But in this particular case, the length of the tube is a lot longer than any other bat could reach. It's 6 centimeters would be long enough prevent any other bat from reaching it.
Mm-hmm.
So the tube goes out to 9 centimeters.
Oh, wow. So how long is this bat's tongue in relation to other nectar-feeding bats?
Let's see, the next longest is probably about 50% as long. Other bats in the same genus is twice as long.
Now, is that for bats all over the world or just in the neotropics?
This group of bats is just in the neotropics. But the nectar bats that can hover and wait, they're from a certain subfamily that only occurs in the neotropics.
Okay. Are there bats with really long tongues in the Old World tropics?
They're fairly long, but they're not as specialized as New World tropic bats. They're fruit bats, and there aren't many species that are super specialized in just feeding on flowers. Most of them also eat fruits.
So am I getting this right? This bat has the longest tongue of any bat discovered so far?
Yes.
Oh.
The longest tongue of any bat. It has, relative to body length, it's actually the longest of any mammal.
So it stores its tongue in its rib cage, and where do other long-tongued bats put their tongue?
It's just like a regular mammal that it's in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the length of the jaws for all other nectar bats, it predicts how long they can extend their tongue really well. In other words, the ones with longer tongues jars.
Right. Okay, cool. So what are some particular challenges that are unique to this kind of research?
Well, it's trickier to study bats because they're nocturnal, so it's tough to get a complete picture of pollination. During the day, you can watch a bee pollinating and then see where it goes next. You can't really track bats very well, so that can be tricky. I tried to use what they call camera traps on bat flowers. That didn't work at all. Because their visits are too quick.
Oh.
Their visits are about like half a second long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so even the fastest camera trap I could find wasn't fast enough to get them visiting flowers.
How much nectar are they taking up in that short a time period?
They manage to extend their tongue to lap up about 3 times in that time period.
How many flowers do these bats typically visit in one night?
I've seen studies that look at how much energy they need per night and how much energy a single flower can give them, and those predict that they need to visit about 3,000 or 4,000 flowers per night.
Wow. So are they mostly finding these flowers by the smell?
That's not that well known yet, and I actually worked with a student who was studying that last year in Ecuador. It looks like both echolocation and smell are important. I'm not sure which is more important in which phase of searching. So in other words, maybe they, as they're flying through the forest, first they rely on smell, and then once they get closer, then they have to switch and rely more on echolocation.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely those are the two signals that are most important for them.
Right.
The flowers are often really well exposed beyond the leaves of the plant, so that the echolocation can pick them up well.
Right.
And there's pretty neat petals that you see a lot of bat-adapted flowers have that are like radar dishes, basically, that reflect the echolocation really well and real specifically back at the bats.
Cool. Does this bat feed on more than just this one flower?
Yeah. Okay, so that's where it starts to get interesting, is that the flower is really specialized to the bat, but the bat feeds on, so far, I think I've recorded it feeding from maybe 15 or 20 different flowers throughout its range. So depending on the habitat you find it in, it's feeding on different things. And even in habitats where the long-tube flower occurs, it's also feeding on other plants at the same time. Here's where I found something interesting. I actually haven't been able to publish this yet. I just figured it out. And I found another species of flower that also evolved a really long tube. The ones that evolved the long tube are the species that use the top of bats' heads.
Oh.
It took me a while to piece this together, but there's other species that use the belly, and species that use the wing. Those don't evolve really long tubes. But what I figured out, I did some experiments in flight cages, I figured out that for whatever reason, when the tube is longer and they have to stretch further down into the flower, they lift their heads up more.
Oh, okay.
So only flowers that are using the tops of bats' heads get any benefit from having longer and longer tubes, from kind of forcing them to really stretch and lift their head up.
Right. Interesting. So are all of the flowers that this bat visits, do they all have relatively long corollas?
No, I've only found two species that have evolved really long tubes. All of the other ones have about maybe maximum of 4 centimeter long tubes, so other nectar bats can also feed them.
Cool. So now, in the southwestern U.S., I'm thinking cactus flowers are pollinated by bats, and they're kind of like, for people who aren't familiar what they look like, it's sort of like an open dish with a bush of anthers, and the bat just sticks its face in it. Are there flowers that look like that are bat-pollinated in the tropics, or are they mostly tubular?
No, cactus flowers are pretty different from tropical flowers. Lots of them have tubes with the nectar at the base, and then the anthers put pollen on the tops of bat's head or the back of their bat. They tend to be bilaterally symmetrical rather than radially symmetrical. So you could take a plane through a radially symmetrical flower through it just about any direction and cut it in half.
Right.
Bilaterally symmetrical is like human. There's just one plane that you have mirror images. So yeah, so the tropical bat pollinated ones, just about everyone that I know of is bilaterally symmetrical.
Okay, that's interesting. So it's more like tropical bat-pollinated flowers are more like what someone would typically think of as a hummingbird-pollinated flower.
Yeah, they often look really similar. They often evolve from hummingbird
Oh, okay.
That might hardly explain why there's a connection.
So there's evidence that the flower species switched from hummingbird to bat pollination?
Yeah, I spent some time looking at all different examples in the tropics that I could find of bat pollination, and just about every case when a plant involves bat pollination, its ancestors were hummingbird pollinated. There's one instance of a switch from bee pollination to bat pollination.
Wow, neat.
It makes sense because morphologically they look pretty similar. They're producing a similar amount of nectar.
Yeah.
Because the body size, they're similar.
So a lot of people, I think, when they hear the word bat, they think of a critter that lives in a cave that's going to suck my blood. So hopefully, listening to this podcast, they'll understand that there are actually a lot of nectar-feeding bats. But where do these little bats sleep during the day?
Yeah, they do sleep in caves. It's not as well known in habitats I work in tropical forests when they don't have caves where they're sleeping, but they found them in just dead bunches of leaves and trees or in trunks of trees. They don't have to sleep in caves.
Right.
They will eat the caves if they're available.
Okay. What has been your favorite part about working with this bat?
I think the discovery. I think learning new things. It's bat pollination isn't that well known. So often I'll find flowers that are bat pollinated that people haven't realized that, but it's not described in scientific literature.
Yeah. Can you think of anything that might relate it to people?
Let's see. So there's some agricultural crops that are bat adapted. Peapock trees are bat pollinated. There's a lot of fruits and cacti that people use to make jams or jelly.
One thing that people can do to help bat pollinators is they live in an area that has bats.
Health and conservation efforts. Bats need their forests. For example, the forests that I'm working in are cloud forests.
Did you say these bats are in a cloud forest?
Yep.
What exactly is a cloud forest?
Cloud forests are high elevation tropical forests. They're really diverse, not quite as biodiverse as lowland rainforests like Amazonian rainforests, but they're different in that they're almost constantly covered in clouds, often really low clouds, so the forests themselves are misty, tend to have lots and lots of epiphytes, of plants living on other plants.
So are these habitats threatened by deforestation?
Yeah, they tend to make for good farmland, so a lot of the habitats are getting destroyed just by people eating farmland or grazing land for their cows.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Once again, thanks for joining me. I'm Athena, the author of Pollinators.info, and you've been listening to Podcast Episode 3, an interview with Dr. Nathan Muchala. If you'd like to join the pollinator conservation movement, just stop by Pollinators.info, click on the Subscribe Here page, give me your name and email address, and you'll get a free weekly email newsletter and free stuff! And don't forget to stay tuned for next month's podcast. Take care now.